Well, maybe you all have heard the story about the guy who lived in a home in a place that was prone to floods. And he was watching the news one night, and he heard the weather forecaster get on and say, "There's a tremendous storm headed our way. If you live in an area that's prone to floods, it's time to evacuate." Well, this man, being a good and faithful man, he went into his room and he began to pray, and he said, "The Lord will provide, God, provide me a way out of this flood." And the next day the rain started to fall, and his neighbor came by and knocked on his door and said, "Hey, we're packing up and we're leaving. We got space in our car. Why don't you get in here with us and go?" And he said, No. "I'm a man of faith and I'm a man of prayer. The Lord will provide." And so he stayed there that night and continued to pray, "God, send me a way out of this flood." And the flood waters started to rise, into they encompassed the first floor of his house. And someone came by, a sheriff in a motorboat, and they called out to him and said, "Hey, we're here with a boat. Get in the boat and we will take you to safety." And he said, No. "I'm a man of faith. I've been praying, and God will provide me a way out of this disaster." Well, the rain kept falling, and the waters kept rising, and finally he had to climb up onto the roof of his house as the waters began to rise. And a helicopter came by from the National Guard. And they dropped down a ladder, and they said, "Climb up, and we will fly you to safety." And the man called out and said, No, "I am a man of faith, and I've been praying. God will provide a way for me out of this disaster." Well, eventually the waters swept him away, and the next thing he knew, he was in heaven, and he appeared before God, and he said, "God, I was a good and faithful man, and I prayed every day, and I just asked you for a way out of that flood, and you did not provide." And God just shook his head and said, "I sent you a weather forecaster. I sent you a neighbor in a car. I sent you a sheriff in a boat. I sent you the Army National Guard in a helicopter. And I was trying to provide for you." Well, it's kind of a silly story, but it helps us maybe get a view of how God answers prayer, but also how God is at work in the world. I know we oftentimes, or at least some of us, myself I know, pray, "God, provide me a way through this time of trial, or provide for me help in this time of need." And certainly, I think most of us probably think of God's miraculous intervention in those moments of time, of trial and difficulty. And certainly, our faith informs us that God does intervene in our lives and miraculous ways. But today, as we stop and think about how God works in the world, I think we begin to recognize, or I hope we can begin to recognize, that more often than not, God works through us. God works through human beings. Today we are continuing our sermon series, "What's the Least I Can Believe and Still Be a Christian?" And this is our fourth Sunday. We spent a Sunday thinking about things we don't have to believe to be a Christian. We spent a Sunday thinking about what matters most to Jesus, the relationships with God and the relationships with others are really Jesus' priority. Last week, T. Paul reminded us that we are called to believe in God's grace, which extends to all of us, a sense of acceptance from God that is given to all of us, regardless of who we are. We are accepted by God and called into lives of faith. And today we're going to think about Jesus' work and really ask ourselves, where is God in the world? And I think that's an important question, because whether we're thinking about floods or natural disasters, or whether we're watching the news and reading about all of the terrible events that we see there, we might be prone to ask that very question, where is God in the world? My spouse works as a psychologist. She's doing an internship, so she's not an official psychologist. But she works at a mental health facility for children and youth, an inpatient facility. And the stories that she brings home are just heartbreaking about the situations that, that these children have been raised in and grown up in and had to deal with in their lives, things that are almost unspeakable, abuse and neglect and just terrible living situations. And when I listen to those stories of things that she deals with on a daily basis, I want to ask, where in the world is God in the world? Where is God? How is God at work in our lives and in our world? And I know that many of you have shared with me stories from your own lives and your own family that are just heartbreaking and gut-wrenching. And we know that many of us have had to deal with situations that are just terrible and destructive sometimes. And in those moments, we ask, where is God in the world? And how is God at work in the world? And so this morning we're going to ask that question, and we're going to try to find a way forward, a way to answer that, at least in some little bit. Now in our call to worship, which is printed on the front page of your bulletin, and which we read and responsibly together this morning, we find the first words from the Gospel of John, one of the four accounts of Jesus and his life and his ministry. And we get this incredible image in the Gospel of John as Jesus existing with and being with and being God from the very beginning. There was not a time in which Jesus did not exist with God. Jesus is part of who God is from the very get-go. And we read those verses and we find that God sent Jesus to this earth. Now, that isn't necessarily revolutionary in terms of religions of the world, but the way in which God sent Jesus to this world is what sets Christianity apart. Jesus was sent to this world not as a spirit, not as a disembodied a ghost, if you will. Rather, God sent Jesus to the world in the flesh, as a human being. As one of you and me. God came and chose to be in this world and revealed in this world in the person of Jesus Christ. And so when we start to think about what is the least I can believe and still be a Christian, when we ask this question, where is God? The way that we answer that as Christian people of faith is God is incarnation. A fancy word which means in the flesh. God chose to come to us to be incarnated as a human being among us upon this world. One of the key, and maybe the key, proclamations of faith in Christianity. That God has come among us in the flesh. In the person of Jesus Christ. And we proclaim as Christians that God is still living among us and still working among us in the flesh, through human beings, through people like you and me. In the Gospel of Luke, we have the story of Jesus at the very beginning of his ministry. And he is just starting out, and he goes to his hometown of Nazareth. And he enters into the synagogue, which would have been the place of teaching, the place of religious worship. And I invite you to hear these words about what happened to Jesus and what Jesus did when he was there. When Jesus came to Nazareth, where he had been brought up, he went to the synagogue on the Sabbath day, as was his custom. And he stood up to read, and the scroll of the prophet Isaiah was given to him. And he unrolled the scroll and found the place where it was written. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he has anointed me, to bring good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim release to the captives and recovery of sight to the blind, to let the oppressed go free, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. And Jesus rolled up the scroll and gave it back to the attendant and sat down. And the eyes of all in the synagogue were fixed on him. And then he began to say to them, "Today this scripture has been fulfilled in your hearing." Now Jesus had just been out in the wilderness. For 40 days and 40 nights he had been fasting, no food, no water. He had been tempted by the devil. And he had come out of the wilderness, out of this intense period of focus and an intense period of testing and trial. And what he does is he begins to teach and he begins to preach. And word is starting to spread about Jesus. Now, the only thing he's done, at least as far as we know in the Gospel of Luke, is teach and share his wisdom and his insight. And so he goes to the synagogue, and word is already kind of starting to spread through the grapevine about Jesus and the things that he is saying and teaching. And they hand him the scroll. They hand him a copy, essentially, of the Old Testament. And he opens it. It's the Old Testament prophet Isaiah, and he begins to read. And he reads those words: "I have come to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor, release of the captives, good news to the poor, recovery of sight for the blind, the oppressed will go free." Now that might sound like good news to us. Freedom. Restoration. And yet what do they do there in the synagogue? But they reject him and they drive him out. They ask him to leave. Asking is probably putting it nicely. But Jesus is forced out of that synagogue. And he goes out and he begins to travel around the countryside, and it's at that time that he begins to heal and perform these miracles. And what he's doing is he's actually embodying, he's putting into practice these words from the Old Testament prophet Isaiah. He's putting them into the flesh, healing people, guiding people, teaching people, restoring them. Now when Jesus quotes from the Old Testament prophet Isaiah, he's going back to a very ancient, I'm going to say tradition. We can debate whether or not it's a tradition here in a moment. But the Old Testament prophet was referring to the book of Leviticus, one of the first five books in the entire New Testament, filled with a lot of the laws and a lot of the rules which govern the people of Israel in their formation and in their time of being called together, drawn together as a people. And when we turn to the 25th chapter of Leviticus, we find these stories and these guidance and these rules about taking a Sabbath. Now we think of a Sabbath as being Sunday, the seventh day. We take every seventh day off and we rest. But in the 25th chapter of Leviticus, we find that the Sabbath was a little bit more than one day. In fact, we get these requirements there that say you will take every seventh year off. And you won't work, and you won't go out, and you won't plow your fields, and you won't prune your plants, and you won't harvest. Even your animals are going to take the seventh year off of work. Sounds pretty good to me. Every seventh year you get to take a year meant to just honor God with your life. Remembering that God at the end of creation, or in the last act of creation, was resting. And so the seventh year was a year of rest. But Leviticus chapter 25 goes on to then describe a week of years, seven sets of 7 years. And so in the 49th year, it was the seventh year of the seventh Sabbath year. And that 50th year was then known as the Jubilee. It was another year that you took off, in which you rested. You didn't plow your fields, you didn't plant, you didn't harvest. Your animals, again, got a second year of rest. So you got the 49th year of rest, and then you got the 50th year of rest, which was known as the Jubilee. And we find here in Leviticus these verses, or these words, that say this: "You shall count off 7 weeks of years, 7 times 7 years, so that the period of 7 weeks of years gives 49 years. Then you shall have the trumpet sounded loud, and on the 10th day of the 7th month, on the Day of Atonement, you shall have the trumpet sounded throughout all your land. And you shall hallow the 50th year, and you shall proclaim liberty throughout the land to all of its inhabitants. It shall be a jubilee for you. You shall return, every one of you, to your property, and every one of you to your family. That 50th year shall be a jubilee for you. You shall not sow or reap the aftergrowth, or harvest the unpruned vines. For it is a jubilee. It shall be holy to you, and you shall eat only what the field itself produces." And so we have these commandments to practice the jubilee every 50th year. Which means in the 48th year, you were trusting God to provide a bountiful harvest that would provide not just for the 49th year, but also the 50th year, and also for all of the time in the 51st year before you brought in that next harvest. It was a tremendous act of faith. But here's what happened also in that year of Jubilee. There was no agricultural work, and all of the family, all of the property returned to its original family. Meaning if you had sold a piece of the family property in the 50th year, it came back to you. And so how this worked is if you bought a piece of property the year after the Jubilee, you probably paid a pretty big price for it because you were going to have that property for 50 years. But if you bought it just 2 years before the Jubilee, it was probably relatively inexpensive because you knew in 2 years it would revert back to its original owner. Interest on loans to the poor were prohibited, and the servants and the slaves of the land were set free. Meaning if you had a slave or a servant, that they were set free in that year. And so what Jesus is doing when he quotes the prophet Isaiah, and what Isaiah was referring to, is this year of Jubilee where everything is restored, where everything is renewed, and where the people are set free and liberated. Now, I said this was a tradition within the Old Testament people. There is no historical proof, no archaeological evidence that the Jubilee was ever actually practiced. We read about it in Leviticus 25, but then we never really hear about it ever again. And so what we know is that this was probably a goal or a vision or an aspiration or a hope that the people had, that this idea of a 50-year Jubilee was something that was what they were aiming for or hoping for in their lives. And so when Jesus gets up and says, I am God's Jubilee year, where all is restored, where all is renewed, where all that is captive and oppressed and living in poverty is set free and renewed and restored and liberated, it's a pretty profound statement. Because he's saying this goal, this idea, this hope that probably hasn't ever really occurred among you is suddenly now being fulfilled. Not just in our hearts and in our minds and in our spirits, but in actual everyday practices. So what Jesus is saying, that I am God in the flesh, come to you, that you might know forgiveness, that you might know acceptance, that you might know the presence and power and the teachings of God, but also so that you may begin to live out these hopes and promises and gifts that God has given you in the flesh. Yesterday I was in Springfield, and I was gathered with a group of pastors from the Ozarks area, and we were at a workshop, a refresher course, if you will, on communion, the Lord's table, when we gather here, as we will next week, and share in the bread and the cup as a remembrance of Christ and Christ's sacrifice and Christ's offering for us. And I was reminded again of a phrase that we say it together as we receive communion, but we receive those as the body and blood of Christ so that we might be the body of Christ for the world, redeemed by his blood. And so our call and what we proclaim, and we'll do it next Sunday together, is that we are called to be the ongoing, the continuation of Christ's body in the world. And so we are called to continue to live out this incarnation of Jesus Christ. So what's the least I can believe as a Christian? That God came to us in the flesh. And God calls us to continue to live out Christ's work in the flesh. And so we ask this question, where is Jesus' work today? Where is Jesus at work, and how is Jesus operating in our world, and how do we know Christ? And where is God? How do we encounter God? Earlier this week, I received an email from someone who isn't even a part of this congregation. Several weeks ago, 2 weeks ago yesterday actually, her father passed away. And she received a prayer card from our prayer group that meets on Wednesday mornings. And she wrote me an email and said, thank you for that prayer card. I can't tell you what an impact it made in my time of need and in my time of mourning to know that there was a group of folks praying for me. And I say that is God at work in the world. Several weeks ago, we received a card in the mail. We cannot figure out who these folks are. And yet, here's what it wrote, what's written in it. Palm de Terre United Methodist Church, thank you and community members for your generosity this holiday season. We appreciate your heartfelt giving for our son's Christmas gifts and our own family meal. And the best we can figure is that this was someone who came at the Share Your Christmas through the Children's Advocacy Council and received food and gifts through this church and others working together to make their holiday season brighter. God at work in the world. Also received this note this past week. On behalf of the officers and board members of Hickory County Cares Food Pantry, I would like to thank the generous people of Palm de Terre United Methodist Church for their support in keeping the food pantry in Wheatland, Missouri open. Your financial support, along with donations of food and volunteer time, has played a significant part in the success of Hickory County Cares. In 3 short months, the number of families served has increased from 180 to 270, and we expect this number to continue to grow. And this could not have happened without your support. I'm very proud to be a member of Palm de Terre United Methodist Church. Sincerely, Dick Rhodes, who is now the president of Hickory County Cares as well. But that is God at work in the world, the ongoing embodiment or incarnation of Jesus Christ. Several months ago, Donna Norris came to me with an article that she had read in our United Methodist newspaper about a program called Puppies for Parole, about a ministry that goes on in the correctional facilities here in the state of Missouri, where inmates are asked to and allowed to train puppies that have come from the pound and prepare them to be adopted into new homes. And it's a program that enables these inmates to learn a new skill, to put their time to good use, and help not only these dogs and themselves, but others who will adopt these dogs into their home. But I think that is a embodiment of Christ at work. And so in this month of February, we are going to have a ministry, start a ministry called Puppy Love. Oftentimes think of February as being Valentine's Day, a month marked by love. But we want to invite you to think of it as puppy love. And there is a basket outside of our sanctuary with a stuffed animal that says puppy love on it with a couple of hearts. And through the month of February, I invite you to bring in items. Dog leashes, dog collars, puppy treats, dog toys, such as this one. And drop those in the basket. And we will then take those to the correctional facility in Fordland, Missouri, where we will pass these off to the inmates there who are working with those pound dogs as a sign and show of our support for them. Now, I started thinking about that ministry. And here are people who are incarcerated, who are in prison. People who, if I had to guess, probably don't have a ton of hope in their lives. And this is our way of simply saying trust that God is working to transform your life, that God is still at work in the world, and that we support you even in your time, knowing that you are serving time for having done something wrong, and we support you in this effort toward rehabilitation, not just of these dogs that have been abandoned, but in your own a movement towards being restored to society. And I started to think, isn't that what Jesus was about and why Jesus came to earth in the flesh? For restoration, to rehabilitate us, as we said in our opening prayer, to restore the dignity of humanity. Didn't Jesus come in the flesh that we might be transformed into the likeness of God? The God that we see in the flesh of Jesus Christ. What's the least I can believe and still believe? Be a Christian. Incarnation. That God has come to us in the flesh. And that God is still calling us to participate in the divine life of Jesus Christ. Thanks be to God. Amen.